Welcome to the Praying with the Eyes podcast. Your host is Doug Bronner, senior pastor at Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Colorado Springs, Colorado. As an avid photographer, Doug combines the beauty of God's creation with the beauty of His Word in a daily Praying with the Eyes devotional blog. Today's discussion digs deeper into a topic first introduced in one of these daily blogs. Thanks for tuning in to today's podcast.
Welcome to this edition of Praying with the Eyes podcast. And for those of you who are new to the podcast, it's actually been going on for a while. I had an internet broadcast for a while on the IB network, and would encourage those of you who had listened to those broadcasts to continue to tune in to the IB network. And if you haven't tuned in, to go there. Tim Wacker, who runs that station, does a very good job, and I appreciate everything he has done for Praying with the Eyes and how he's got it started. But we've now got these podcasts going, and it's a lot of fun to do these. Praying with the Eyes is a ministry of Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and you can find more out about Holy Cross at www.holycrosscs, that's in Colorado Springs, holycrosscs.org. Anyway, I've been writing blogs for about, it's going to be almost 3 years here, and where I take a picture that I've taken and combine it with scripture and a short devotion, and I've been enjoying doing that. Now, I don't claim to be a fantastic photographer, but I do enjoy it. I take as many pictures as I can, and that was obvious this week when our tech guy at church tried to back up my hard drive as we switched to a new server, and it took me 4 hours to back up my hard drive. A little bit of pictures on my hard drive. Anyway, the title of today's podcast is Doomed to Repeat? We're going to take on my guest and I, my co-host today, and I are going to take on a quote by Edmund Burke, who said, "Those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it." Get at that more in a second. We're going to talk about the importance of history as it relates to us today. And I know for some of you, study of history is not necessarily something that you're interested in, or for others of it, you may be a passion of yours. I really pray you stick with us. Don't tune us out because you heard that word history, because we want to make this very relevant to the church today, the Christian community today, as we talk about the early church and what it has to say to us in the church of the 21st century. The blog that I wrote has a different title that we're going to look at in the fourth segment of this podcast today, and that is Where Are the People? And it's a picture I took a while back. I actually took it with my iPhone in the Lloyd Center Mall in Portland, Oregon, and I'll talk about that. But if you want to look at that picture now, you can go ahead and go to the Praying with the Eyes website, and it's there. The website's up. It's wonderful to have that up and going. I really am grateful for it. But everything is getting consolidated into that website now, prayingwiththeeyes.com, just as it sounds. And I'd love to have you go there. And if you go there now, you'll find the picture for this podcast today. I'd love to have you email me at prayingwiththeeyes@gmail.com if you have any questions or thoughts, and keep the conversation going. Two important values to these podcasts. One is that we share Christ, and the second is that we find connections with each other. So emailing and keeping the conversation going is important. Again, that's that. You can email me at prayingwiththeeyes@gmail.com. My guest today is a very special person in my life. You have heard from two of his relatives already, both in the broadcast before. You heard from his father and his brother. I have with me today Ben Nicodemus, the youngest of the brothers and the most intelligent of all. You're not arguing.
Well, I always believe that.
Yeah. And you let your brothers know it too, right?
Precisely. That's why we get advanced degrees.
Yes. Ben, and there's a reason why I have Ben on. Ben has been with us here. We're sitting in my home across the dining room table recording this today. And as Ben and I have been talking the last couple of days here, visiting his brother who pastors at Bethel Lutheran Church here in town. That's Dave Nicodemus, who was on the first broadcast of Praying with the Eyes back on the IB network. Anyway, we spent quite a bit of time together talking about our faith, talking about the early church and how it relates to today. And so I said to him yesterday if he wanted to do a podcast with me, he agreed. So you are still an adjunct professor at Concordia University in Portland, right?
Yeah, this is actually, I've just finished up my fifth year as an adjunct in the theology department, mostly teaching New Testament, Old Testament, and some what we call theory of religion, philosophy of religion kind of topics.
And even though you got a big change coming, right?
Yeah, actually, I'm heading off to...
No, before that.
I'm getting married.
Yeah, okay, yeah, so, come on, Ben.
Well, you know, I assume we're talking about academic topics, but yes, I'm getting married, and then and this summer, and then next fall, I'll be heading to St. Louis, getting my PhD in New Testament exegetical theology.
So. But and your love is still your work that you did for your master's. The early church fathers, we call it, which really includes just early church history, a lot of early church history.
Right. What you find is whenever you study the New Testament or the early church, these distinctions between New Testament or church fathers really start to melt away. And what you really have is a dynamic that the New Testament was created in a world, it lived in a world, it was acted in a world, and that world continues in the next several centuries. And to understand any of it, you really need to get into the bulk of how that all fits. And that's what I've always been interested in. Who were the readers? Who were the hearers? What did this mean to them?
Well, and just go further with that, Ben, because it's not only that those worlds connect, our world connects to theirs. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, the older I get, the more I realize time is really fleeting. I mean, I used to think that 500 years... 1,000 years a long time ago. It's not. It's just really a drop in the bucket of time. And so really, that early, we're part of that story.
Yeah, and that's right, is particularly when we're in faith traditions that value the Bible so much, part of our integral identity is in those early pieces. You really have two choices. One is to basically be ignorant and not realize that how much that has influenced us. And that's true for those in faith traditions and those who aren't. The knowing this segment of time between 200 BC, 400 BC, until about 400 AD is absolutely essential to who we are as Western humans, and particularly as Western Christians.
Yeah, and yet we don't. We forget our history. So that brings us back to the quote. So Burke, you shared that quote with me, and then I went back and looked at his life. And so what little I know of him was that in the House of Commons during the time of the American colonies, he was actually arguing for the colonies. And I wonder if his quote has... That is part of the background, that he was afraid of George III, King George III, repeating history because he didn't understand history. But he said, again, that the quote is, and I'm sure many of you have heard this before, at least variations of it, "Those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it."
Precisely. And this quote is an aphorism anymore. I mean, very few people know Edmund Burke. Nobody knows this situation, but they use the phrase very frequently.
Right.
And the problem with it is it's a lovely little phrase. It's catchy, but historically it doesn't really play out. If you look at a variety of examples throughout history, people have, quote, repeated history, knowing full well that this had happened before. You know, if you look at even the whole history of the Roman Empire, all they had to do was look to what happened with Alexander the Great, and they would have discovered when you create an empire rather than a republic, it doesn't last a certain time, particularly when you're interested in conquest and expansion. It works to actually conquer the lands, but then you can't really hold that empire. This is repeated again and again, and it's not as if the Roman empires were ignorant of history. They knew their history. They just kept doing it.
And then just bringing it to a little bit more modern history is Hitler had the same ideas. And he was a student of Roman history, tried to emulate some of it, and yet it, he so knowing history, you're saying, but you had another phrase. You tweaked his a bit that was interesting.
Right, and the key for me, and this is when I'm teaching, what I really try to emphasize is that it's knowing something doesn't really do anything. That's too often how history is done. It's just this boring, well, there's a number of facts, and that's kind of interesting, and you go home along with your life not even thinking about it. The goal of history is for us to learn its lessons. Right. To know the data is one thing, but you've got to learn the lesson behind it.
Well, and I assume behind that learning the lesson, again, is not fact-based. It's about the consequences of things.
Precisely. There is no way. I mean, the other aspect of Burke's comment that I would not agree with is that history really repeats itself. You learn lessons, but every situation is new in some way. But what it isn't new, what is very much the case, is there are lessons of the human experience that are available for us to learn, so that our quote new situation doesn't seem so new and daunting. You don't have to go at it completely as a blank slate, and instead you can go into just the what have people done in situations like this. Now, we recognize they're different, but there's lessons there. There's things we learn about how humans interact and why they interact. One of the fundamental assumptions of history, theology, most of academics in any way, is that humans make sense eventually. You can understand why people are doing it. Maybe not logically the way that we would like logic, but definitely the way that you would think of, is there a reason people are doing this? Most people do have kind of a reason they're doing this, and we can learn that, and we can see why it's happening. And those are the really important moments for us to understand, and then that makes history come alive. Those are the things we put into our own life.
Okay, so we're 20 centuries later than the first two centuries of the church. Why is it important for us to learn the lessons of the first and second century Christians for us in the 21st century?
Well, there's a variety of reasons, but a lot of the reasons is because there is too much right now of idealizing the first century. That church was a particular thing, and then we want to take that and just replace it. That's not learning its lessons. What we want to do is we want to understand our New Testament as a book of faith, and we want to understand what it meant and what lessons it's teaching us, what is going on, and what were the people afterward who were reading this, who were hearing it? What were they figuring out? One thing we understand about the early church is where we gained a lot of our identity, things we don't even realize we're assenting to without going forward, is that they were developed by people, and the way theology was developed was people trying stuff out. They were trying out how does it work in one community? How does it work in another community? And they were very open to what is a living faith really all about. And the important thing that's so important for us now is that we need to understand what those communities were like. Because if we don't understand that, you really can't understand the New Testament, which is our foundational doctrine of faith.
It's a living document. It's not just a, you know, I get myself in trouble, but it's not just a historical document. So many people treat it, even Christians treat it, just purely as a historical document. Well, let's you know, the reason why this is important to me, Ben, and you and I, as we talked, is as a pastor, I hear two things in the 21st century confronting the Christian community. One is people saying, well, we need to get back to what the Church of Acts was specifically. Now, Ben and I, as we talk, we're not talking specifically about the book of Acts. That's one slice of that first and second century. But we got to go beyond that. And so we're going to be talking, and when we talk early church, we are, yes, including the book of Acts, but more than that. But so I hear people saying, on the one hand, we got to become like that. And then I hear another school of people, similar, but saying a little different, is that the world we live in today is much like what second century Christian communities faced. And so we're going to take that on. But do before, just for a few minutes here, Ben, before we take a break, do we really know what the church looked like?
Well, you know, we actually, you know, this is a challenge with ancient history. We just don't have the kind of data we have for the church now, for instance. But we really know a lot more than we're often led to think. Too often, as you said, a lot of people say, well, if we just made our church more like the Book of Acts. Well, if all we had was the Book of Acts, and we really wanted to do that, that'd be one thing. But we really have a lot of data. We know a lot about the earliest church. We know varieties of different communities and what they were holding. We know how they were received in the Roman Empire. We even can hypothesize with some reasonable doubt, Rodney Stark has done this very well in his book, Rise of Christianity, even how quickly the church was growing. You know, and so what we have is we really can do a lot more than simply just kind of throwing up our hands and saying, well, the Book of Acts says this, so that must have been the case. If you look at the rest of the New Testament, you see other pictures.
Yeah, but even there, yeah. We don't even know. We hear in the end of chapter 2 of Acts, right after the Pentecost community was being formed, we hear that, you know, they broke bread together, they fellowship, they share, and all this stuff. But it's only a few verses, and to extrapolate out of that a whole what that looked like, we don't have a clue.
Right, exactly. And that's how you do ancient history. Is when I say we have a lot of data, what I mean is that we have a number of pieces of data we put together, and then maybe we could start putting together a picture.
Okay.
You know, so if you say, for instance, with the Book of Acts, a great example is what Paul says about this community, what they say about themselves. And you'll notice they don't always agree with one another, not just themselves, who did not agree, but also even the accounts sort of slightly disagree. That's the richness for us, because that shows us part of the value is we don't know everything, but we have enough data to show what a real hypothesis, what really could be going on in this earliest phase.
And this is important for us today. We're not just talking. We're going to make the application to this today because of those two questions that I face. So Ben and I are going to take a break here. And after the short break, we're going to come back and talk about probably what influenced the early church more than anything else. We'll be back in a moment.
Are you looking for a place where you can be welcomed as you are? A place where your thoughts are welcomed as well as your doubts? A place where you can talk about God without being judged? Then I invite you to join the life-changing experience of Life Tree Cafe. At Life Tree Cafe, you will spend an hour gathering with others to experience a host-led discussion over topics ranging from serious to fun and quirky. For more information about Life Tree Cafe and for a location near you, visit their website at www.lifetreecafe.com. If you live in the Colorado Springs community, you are more than welcome to join us at Holy Cross for one of three Life Tree experiences on Monday or Tuesday over the lunch hour from 11:45 to 12:45, or on Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m. Life Tree Cafe. Come join the conversation.
Once again, the Praying with the Eyes ministry is a part of a bigger ministry of Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Colorado Springs, Colorado. You're sure welcome to find out more about Holy Cross at holycrosscs.org. And again, if you have questions for me, and if you have them for Ben as well, you can email me and I'll get those to Ben. One central place to email them to us is at prayingwiththeeyes@gmail.com. So, Ben, what shaped the life of the Christian community more than anything else in the first and second century?
The single most important social factor, and when I say social factor, I just mean the way people lived in their regular lives. Don't over-academicize that aspect.
That's hard for you to say because that's where you spend all your life.
It's true, but there's a lot of terms like this that are a major problem. You know, we don't use them outside of these kind of terms, but they're perfectly good words. But what I mean by that is just the thing that really shaped the way people interacted was the Roman Empire making Christianity illegal and the persecutions that the church faced both from the empire and then just from society in general.
Okay, but I think most of us, when we think about the persecution of early Christians, we think of it in terms of this worldwide, empire-wide, persecution of Christians, but that's not always what it was. In fact, maybe not even the majority of it was.
No, in fact, that's a really good point, because it's the challenge with understanding early Christian persecution was that it was, you know, to the point where you got someone to say, if you see a Christian, kill it, kind of thing, it will not be until the year 251 AD. So there is, before that, we have...
That didn't, you told me that didn't even last that long.
3 years is all okay. It lasts, 251, 254. It's called the Decian persecution under Emperor Decius. But really, it was very sporadic. It was, and quite rare, actually, for it to occur. It always was a kind of threat. It could happen because it was an illegal organization, and it was, but the actual persecution and actual executions of Christians was really quite rare. There's really, if you count up all the ones we know about, the total number is something around the 200, and this is from the beginning of Christianity until when it becomes legal under Emperor Constantine.
But you say that it's still, we've had this conversation this weekend, that you still say that that is the biggest influence on the Christian community. So what was it that, if it's not that many that were being killed, actually killed, what was it that made persecution such a important factor?
Well, there were a variety of things. If we're going to look at it just sociologically, why does a group succeed or fail? Why does it grow or fail? Any group, and I don't care if it's religious or anything else, any group will automatically fail if the people in it do not have a sense of urgency and a sense of identity that know why they're there. The worst thing that a group can have is no difference between when they're in the group and when they're when the people who aren't in the group.
I'm going to assume, though, let's take on the urgency for a second, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but just so we help our listeners understand, within the Christian community, there was a sense of urgency. And as I read the New Testament, and I don't know if you read the same way, Ben, but it seemed that the urgency always centered around the imminent return of Jesus.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Paul would go even farther, right? When is it that, if you read Romans 11, when is it that Jesus is going to finally return? Well, when that full number of Gentiles has been reached, right? Our very work was hastening that imminent return.
Right,
and so there
was
an urgency. But what I mean by urgency here is slightly different. What I meant was the sense that people, the what we would call now kind of lukewarm believers kind of thing, that kills a community, right? If what is it you always hear about criticism of Christians now? You hear the question, well, these people, they go to church, but then they don't act any differently in their regular lives. And really what people are saying is that these people really don't hold their faith as very important in their lives. This isn't something that really matters enough. And that's something that persecution solves.
That's what I was going to say. That's what I was thinking. Persecution seems to be that factor that you don't have lukewarm.
Precisely. You're not going to be part of this group if there's even a slight chance that this could lead to like a death scenario. And that is precisely what the early church used. And that was one major aspect of why this was so important. But bigger than that, I think, in its earliest going, if you look at the numbers of converts, even if you count them all up from this in Acts and what Paul says and everything we know, which is not the whole picture, but everything we know, you don't see a huge group of people, given the context of the Roman Empire. But what did the Roman Empire do? They said they didn't understand Christianity very well, but they felt they were important enough that they needed to be addressed and they needed to be stymied. Well, what did this say to everyone else who'd never even heard of Christianity? Well, they would say, I don't know what in the world this movement is, but apparently they're really doing something. The state is concerned about them. And we're talking about an empire that's a polytheistic empire. You know, when they would go conquer a new land, they had no problem with other people with different religions. You know, don't worry, we have a lot of gods. We'll just incorporate them. But apparently not this one. What's going on here? And it led to all types of the people in the empire knowing more about Christianity than they ever would have.
Okay, so And in early church, especially the first century, my understanding is that this movement of Christians, or whatever they were called by the Romans, was still pretty well associated with the Jews. Is that true or not? I know that this is a struggle in Acts. It's absolutely, and I think in Paul's letters, and we've talked about James, your love, there's a struggle between Jewish and Gentile believers.
And there is, and that's actually really interesting, because within the church, that is a major issue. Are they going to be different than Jews? How are they going to be different than Jews?
Right.
Are they just a sect of Judaism? And how does that all work? The Romans, interestingly, because Judaism was a really ancient religion, they sort of respected Jews. They didn't really like them that much, but they didn't.
Wasn't there kind of a Jewish quarter, too, within Rome itself?
Yes. There was. There were, and Alexandria in Egypt had a large number of Jews, a very large population. So there were a number, they knew what it was, and they didn't like this monotheism thing, but they tolerated it, sort of. There was some persecution. Christians, as long as they were called just Jews, actually kept that same moniker. But if we look at any group, any writing about early Christians, and this includes, say, the Gospel of Matthew, which is supposed to be the most Jewish gospel, however we read it, it's always trying to include Gentiles. At the end of it, it says, go and make disciples of all the nations. Nations is the same word as Gentiles. Go to all the Gentiles.
Right.
So the Romans knew something different was happening here.
So they actually did make a separation then between the Jews and Christians.
They did. And you know that by many people have heard of the famous fire in Rome under Emperor Nero in about the year 60. And at this, there was a great fire in downtown Rome. Nero charges the Christians as a distinct group. Now, that's important, as a distinct group, as the ones who started it. Now, are the people who've written it most are rather sure that Nero started this fire himself so he could have that prime real estate to rebuild his new imperial palace, which no longer stands. It was destroyed after his
death.
But
he did build it, right?
But he built it, and he wanted to do that. But the point for showing it is already at that time, so, you know, 30 years after Jesus dies, the Roman emperor is seeing Christians as something different from Jews.
Which, in really, you talk 30 years, that's not a lot.
No, it really is not. And particularly, you know, we need to be very honest about the challenge these early Christians have. So far as we know, Jesus wrote no books. He left no writings at all. And and if you read through the Gospels, His messages to the church are not voluminous. You know, how you're supposed to organize after he's gone. I mean, he talks about he's going to send his helper. He has a few comments here and there. But we don't have a very obviously organized movement that he's going to have set up. They have to figure all of that out. And you see that with Paul's letters. You see that with the book of Acts. You see it in the book of Hebrews. There's a lot of variation. There's a lot of differences of people, how they're trying to work these things out.
Okay, so that brings us to the next point we want to take. So if persecution is this formative influence on the early Christians, what influence did it have on what the church believed and practiced? I think most people listening to this podcast have an understanding or think, for some reason, that the church, the early church in the first and second centuries, were pretty united in what they practiced and believed. Is that true?
Well, yeah, that's precisely the idea that's often presented. I hear it all the time, and unfortunately, it's absolutely not true. It's the opposite was the case, that it was amazing diversity there. And if you see this, you know, those listening, I assume you know at least some about the New Testament. And if you see this, you see this among the New Testament writings. You have the book of Hebrews, for instance, which really is arguing for a theology of replacement. That is, there was this old temple, and it's obsolete, not necessary, and we don't really need this anymore. And we're moving on to something else, and we've replaced it. We would say Christians have become the new Jews, the new Israel. That's this view. Then take Paul. Paul, a very different approach. If you look at it, Paul's saying that the Gentiles have been adopted into the line of Israel. Now, that's not supplanting anything. Now, where does this matter? In Paul's communities, and particularly in Romans, there's good reason to think there are Jews who are still practicing as Jews in these communities. Right? He has a problem with that in the book of Galatians, but that's mostly because they're not Jews and they're pretending and trying to be, and you don't need to. And he thinks the time is so short, there's no reason. But the diversity is amazing. And then you see in Galatians the fights he's having with people, right? He and Peter don't get along on this topic. And what they're really dialoguing with is they're suggesting Peter thinks eventually that there should be this big division in the church between Jews and Gentiles. There's some reason to think that the Gospel of Matthew wants Gentiles to join, but it also wants them to keep following Torah commandments, to really be fully Jewish. You know,
I guess what I'm getting at too, when you're saying this, Ben, is we call denominationalism as a part of our world today. And it's not just theology. I always lump theology and practice together here. We think that if we were just more like the early church, all of our Christian denominations would get together and everything would be fine, when in reality, that's not what the early church was.
No, and quite frankly, most scholars, when they talk about this early period, they don't talk about early Christianity. They talk about early Christianities. What you actually have is very similar to what we would call denominationalism now. The only difference was how small the groups were, but they did interact with one another, and they did not get along with one another. They were constantly dialoguing. They were constantly trying to establish this, and there is marked similarity between that and now. There is, I think, the idea that denominationalism started like at the Reformation, or maybe people who know a bit more would say, well, the Great Schism in 1054 AD, is that's when denominations started. But really, denominations have always been part of the system.
Well, even within the Catholic Church, before it's Roman Catholic, the Catholic Church, the bishops within that Catholic Church. Well, let's go back. We'll go back to early or the first two centuries. You were sharing with me, it seems like that these churches, these Christian communities, let's call them, let's not call them churches, these Christian communities, they all had a bishop that was leading them, and these bishops struggled with each other.
Yeah, they did. And they even struggled with their own communities too. You know, one of the great bishops of the early church is Saint Athanasius. Many people will have heard of the Athanasian Creed. This is who it's named for. And he wrote many very important books. His little pamphlet, it's really a pamphlet called On the Incarnation of the Word, really is one of those formative books that was just read everywhere. Most people don't know he was actually exiled from being a bishop 5 different times during his own lifetime. By other bishops and his own congregants at times. And so the idea that there was some sort of automatic harmony because this thing is a long time ago is the way we like to revise the past so that it fits our view now.
Okay, those
right?
of you from Holy Cross listening to this, don't get any ideas about exiling me. You may want to.
Well, it's Athanasius always got a power source by going out to the people in the desert. So that'll be your new.
Yeah, we live in Colorado.
Yeah, there you go.
Plenty of desert. Okay, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, as we continue to discuss this issue of the early church and its influence on us and this whole idea of whether we're to become like the early church, and really identifying with people who were broken, sinful people, yet lived under the cross of Jesus Christ, much like we do. We're going to take on a couple of very important topics that come out of this idea of theology and practice, and we hope you'll stick with us after this break. And we'll be back shortly.
At Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Colorado Springs, Colorado, we encourage those who hunger to be nourished by God. We believe that true nourishment in our lives is met in our Creator and Redeemer God. At Holy Cross, we proclaim the message that our God desires intimacy with us through His Son, Jesus Christ, and that worship is an experience of this intimacy. To find out more about worship styles and times, visit our website at www.holycrosscs.org. And if you don't live in the Colorado Springs community or you are part of a different Christian community, we encourage you to join God's people as He nourishes His relationship with you.
Well, I'm glad you've chosen to stick with us today in this podcast as my guest Ben Nicodemus and I continue to talk about the early church, the Christians that lived in the first and second centuries, and the relevance to us today. I know we're talking a lot about the church in the past, but we hope to tie some of this together by the two topics we're going to bring up next. And they're very relevant to us today as they were to the early church. And the first one we're going to take on is going to be worship. Just a reminder before we do that again, if you want to find out more about Praying with the Eyes, I invite you to go to our website, which is very simple, prayingwiththeeyes.com. There's other people writing blogs there to encourage and help you, challenge you, to help you in your Christian walk. So please do that. So we've talked about the impact of persecution and the struggle the early church had to in theology and practice that it didn't always agree. I mean, that in itself could have been a podcast, really talking about the differences to get into detail about that, but they were there. But let's talk about two very critical issues because they apply to us today and throughout the generations of Christians. And so let's take on, first of all, worship. We've talked about the diversity in practice and theology. What about worship? Was there a unity in worship practice?
Well, that's really interesting. The things done on what we would think of as a Sunday morning, for them it was usually Sunday night.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, because in the Roman Empire, there's no days off. You work every day. And so the only days...
Boy, does that sound familiar.
So as a result, and you worked as long as there was light. So the only time there is to meet was in the middle of the night. And this was actually one of the reasons the Romans were skeptical of them, was because they met in the middle of the night, and we don't know what you're doing in there. You know, you could be very well plotting against the state. You know, that, and Romans had a big problem with people getting together and having meetings. They didn't like that if there was no Roman official there.
Yeah, I could see that.
Particularly in the provinces.
I don't think that changed. I think that we human creatures, if we're in power, we don't want people to meet. You can think of unions. You can think of secret meetings that people have had. Churches have that. I've had that in my ministry where there were secret meetings. So we don't like it. That's a human tendency.
Precisely. So they would meet. But what they did there, what's really interesting, while they very much disagreed in who would be in their communities, that was always a disagreement, and how it would look to be a living member in their communities, the actual worship practices were relatively similar in that.
Really?
If you read what we know about it, you'll find that there are almost always a reading of a text. Some have kind of an exposition, kind of a homily, and then you had the Lord's Supper. And there was a prayer here and there. But really, what's interesting is the ritual acts done. That is, readings, preaching, and sacrament. That's mostly what they would do, which is rather similar to what we do. Were really done relatively universally because that's what you really see. If there's one thing the early church knew about Jesus, even before there was a New Testament, it was the command to enact this Lord's Supper in a regular basis. So there was rather different opinions about who could be included, how they'd look, what their lives, but what they actually did in the worship service. Now that was relatively similar.
Okay. I see. That kind of surprises me with the other issues of diversity in theology and practice. My assumption is then that one of the reasons for that more uniform liturgy, I know that some people are going, that's a bad word. It's not. It's a wonderful word. For that liturgy was the Lord's Supper. I'm assuming that the Lord's Supper, and I'm listening to you, I'm hearing some also influences still of Judaism.
Oh, yeah.
Like the reading of Scripture, reading the Torah, which would have been a part of...
Right. Well, and you see the influence of Judaism. I mean, in the first place, even having Scriptures is an influence from Judaism. Why did they do that? Well, they already had Scriptures. They wanted some now about this new understanding they had.
Where it was, I'm going to make a stupid, this is going to be a stupid question, but I think it's important. We, as Christians today, are thinking that was what we call the New Testament. But it also, because of Paul's words, I'm assuming that when he talks about inspiration to Timothy, he's talking about the inspiration of what the Hebrew Bible.
Right, and in fact,
so that must have been a part of, that was major, especially the first century Christians, that's what they had.
Yes, that was their Bible. And almost always the Greek version of the Hebrew Bible is what they had, the Septuagint. And that was their Bible. And they... And when you read the New Testament, if there's one thing you can find in every book, it is the rampant citation of the Hebrew Bible. And the reason is simple. They were presenting new writings, and they wanted people to be convinced. And how are you going to do that? Well, we use your sacred scriptures. And so that is it is absolutely, that was their Bible, and then the idea of having sacred writings, though, which other religious traditions do not necessarily have, was automatic to them. This makes sense. And so the readings were just made sense. And so did the Lord's Supper in that way. Because, you know, one of the hardest things to do is to get into the world of the first century. That's what I tell my students. You know, it's easy to understand a piece of data about what they did. Very hard to understand a world where that made sense. You know, a really quick example is literacy. Most people know that only about 5% of the people could read. But what people struggle to understand is that it was a society where you didn't need to read. Our society is so literate. I mean, if you can't read, you're lost.
I think that's a critical point.
And that's exact for them. The Lord's Supper was not that unusual, because both Jews and Greco-Roman religion, sacrifice was very, very common. And the idea that there needed to be a sacrifice for a expiation of sin made a lot of sense. The only thing that was confusing to them was that they weren't doing the sacrifice right in front of them the way, you know, you didn't bring the animal in. Instead, this is in Jesus on the cross. But the Lord's Supper was this enaction of the Jesus' body and blood in their real life. That made sense to them in a way that is very difficult for it to make sense to us.
And I think that's critical. When we talk about the difference between worship, and this is an argument in the church today, how often should we have communion? Okay, and it's one that we are having, that our leadership has had in our congregation at Holy Cross, they wrestle with, should we offer it every Sunday? You know, I grew up remembering barely that when I was very young, that we had communion once a quarter.
Right.
Okay, and then it was once every month. That's what I remember most.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been in a church where it's been practiced every Sunday. Maybe I take that back. My fieldwork church in St. Louis during my time at seminary, I think, did it for 1 year while we were there.
Well, that's a perfect example. That conversation is a perfect example with frequency of, let's make sure we're understanding the lesson from history and not just trying to say, well, we're going to do the same thing. They did communion every Sunday. They also had a really different understanding of what the worship service was for than we do. For one really key point was that, you know, we have a big argument in the Lutheran church how closed or open communion should be. Should we allow people who don't really know, or we haven't talked to, should we have a private confession beforehand? You know, how are we going to manage it? For them, it was a non-issue because of a different reason. That is, really, the whole worship experience was basically closed because it was an illegal gathering, because this is persecution, that nobody was going there to the worship service who was just curious.
Okay.
And so what we need to do is understand the lesson. You know, here is an example of, well, yes, they did communion every Sunday. It's a completely different kind of worship service than we have, though.
Well, but that's going to get us into the second issue we want to talk about. So I'm really glad you said that. But let's that's where the worlds are not the same.
Right.
Okay. That maybe in some areas of this globe where the Christian community gathers, it is outlawed. Okay. And so they have, it is a closed community similar to that. Not in the United States, not in Western, in the Western cultures. So it presents a different issue. So going back and saying, okay, we have to have it every Sunday because that's what the early church did. I'm not saying we shouldn't have it every Sunday, but to use that argument as a basis for doing it, let's understand the world.
Right, precisely, precisely. And what concerns me most as a scholar in this field is the way people use the early church dismissively, saying that there's someone in on one side of the table who, if we're going to use this example, says, well, I think we should really only, you know, I want to do it only quarterly, and I want to do private confession beforehand or something like that. A very aggressive
view. Because
it
makes it more meaningful.
Right. And what I don't like is the other person saying, well, the early church didn't do that, as if that ends the argument. See, then we're not dialoguing anymore. And that's how we can guarantee we're not going to learn anything from the early church.
There's another podcast about how do we dialogue. How do we relearn how to dialogue with each other? So witnessing, the early Christian community had this urgency to share Christ. In 20th century, a lot of my ministry spent with in the 20th century, there was really taught that evangelism, sharing our faith, happened in the context of worship. So we had seeker-sensitive worship services. But that doesn't appear to be the way the early church operated with sharing their faith.
Yeah, no, not at all. The worship service was for believers to come together to interact with God. That was what it was for. If we were to take it in the sense of the that it was the way theology professors talk about it, this is the vertical relationship, right? This was for we, the community of belief, to come together. And yes, there was an interest of coming together. Right, the famous, this is one of the rituals we've kept and forgotten the meaning. We do the passing of the peace at the beginning.
Right.
In the early church, that was firmly understood as forgiveness. That is, before we have communion together, we make sure there's no challenges with one another. It was the sacred kiss. They'd kiss each other on the cheek at that point. And really what they were doing was, it was very significant, saying we're coming together so we're ready to worship. And then they would interact with their God, and that was the full point. There really was no idea that these services were going to like bring other people into the church.
Okay, so
you didn't bring
that happen?
Your buddy in.
Did that happen then? Where did they share their faith?
Well, and here's the key issue is what would happen is the best example we have is Paul, right? If you look at Paul, what does he do when he goes to a new area? He doesn't just start going and preaching. He takes a job. And through that job, I mean, he says he works with his hands. The book of Acts says he works in leather or tent making or however you translate that term. And he takes that job. And through that, he interacts with culture around him. And he spreads his faith day-to-day interaction, not at the worship service. Instead, it's the regular interactions he has. This is an important lesson that I think we can learn now, is that you don't change culture by yelling at it. You change culture by interacting and producing within it.
Well, and that's not just an issue of Christianity. I mean, there's so much screaming in the world right now. We're so polarized on opinions that seems to be the way we think it happens. But, okay, so you and I talked earlier, yesterday or whenever it was, about the marketplace.
Yeah.
And that concept of the marketplace. Why don't you explain quickly what that marketplace was in that world?
Well, yeah, this is, you're working in a almost completely free economy. We don't have that anymore in the modern world, truly, in the sense of, the marketplace was where everyone came together, no oversight whatsoever. But what happened, and of course it's the agora is the famous term, and in that, not only was commerce done, but that's also where people interacted. This was their interaction with people. Again, they work every day. So this is where you have a chance, because you're working. You have a chance to interact with one another, and you also have a chance to really dialogue. The famous examples are, if you look at any philosophers, the probably most famous is probably Socrates, but you look, and that's in Greece, but you go all the way up into Rome. I mean, the same would be the case with Diogenes. The same would be the case really even with Philo, the famous Jewish Alexandrian. And all of these figures, they go in the marketplace and they dialogue, they talk, they go through things. That's the interaction point. That's the point where people really got together in community in order to really have some real conversation. Now, if you were very rich, you might get together for other reasons, but most people worked all day. And okay, so that's okay.
So that marketplace, but there's so many marketplaces. Well, no, I guess what I'm trying to say, we haven't defined the marketplace today. I had a good example that I blogged on this recently, when we were in Luderstadt, Wittenberg, in Germany, on a Saturday, the marketplatz, was filled with people, all sorts of races, all sorts of different people, and it gave me that picture, even a modern picture of what that was like. We don't have time to go into this, but boy, I wish we did. It's got to be another conversation of what is the marketplace, because I guess what's most important for me, and then we're going to take a break here, is to understand that in sharing their faith, there was personal accountability in sharing that faith. It was not upon the professionals, which you and I talked about earlier, about the Constantinian time period where things start to shift. It wasn't their job. I'll just bring them to the professionals, and the professionals will share the faith with them. And in that we need unto that's another lesson to learn from history. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the blog I wrote, which is entitled "Where Are the People?" We'll be back in a moment.
Are you looking for a place where you can be welcomed as you are? A place where your thoughts are welcomed as well as your doubts? A place where you can talk about God without being judged? Then I invite you to join the life-changing experience of Life Tree Cafe. At Life Tree Cafe, you will spend an hour gathering with others to experience a host-led discussion over topics ranging from serious to fun and quirky. For more information about Life Tree Cafe and for a location near you, visit their website at www.lifetreecafe.com. If you live in the Colorado Springs community, you are more than welcome to join us at Holy Cross for one of three Life Tree experiences on Monday or Tuesday over the lunch hour from 11:45 to 12:45, or on Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m. Life Tree Cafe. Come join the conversation.
Welcome back to the last segment of this edition of Praying with the Eyes. I would encourage you to go to the website, prayingwiththeeyes.com. And if you have questions or thoughts, please email me at prayingwiththeeyes@gmail.com. So we talked about a picture that I wrote a blog, the blog entitled "Where Are the People?" The picture is the Lloyd Center in Portland, Oregon. This is an old mall. And if I'm not mistaken, it was probably I think when it was first constructed, it was one of the largest malls. Of course, in the 60s, 1960, there weren't many malls at all. I mean, that wasn't what we did. And it was an open-air mall in those days. And I remember going as a kid. I was born in 56. I'm dating myself here. So I was four at the time that the Lloyd Center was built. Ben was not even near being a thought yet in those days. I remember going up from Eugene, driving up there, and what impressed me was that they had an ice skating rink. And there wasn't no ice skating rink in Eugene where I grew up. I've never been on ice skates, and I will never be on ice skates. But anyway, it's a pretty big mall. It's now enclosed. And what's interesting, if you're looking at this picture, this huge mall, there's nobody in it. And I wasn't that early in the morning. It might have been, if I remember right, it's been a while since I took it. But there's nobody down this hallway. And that's just seems so abnormal for malls. And related that then to an old children's rhyme that we have in the church. Some of you have heard it before. I was taught it as a child, where you put your hands together and you say, here is a church, here is a steeple, open the doors and see all the people, and you wiggle your fingers. And it hit me as saying, I'm looking this, and I'm going, well, where are all the people? And sometimes I feel that way in worships too. Where are the people? And I tied Hebrews 12:25 to this picture, where the writer states, we should not stop gathering together with other believers, as some of you are doing. Instead, we must continue to encourage each other even more as we see the day of the Lord coming. And that's a quote from God's Word to the Nations translation. I understand the writer to the Hebrews here. We don't know who it was. But I understand the writer to mean more than coming to worship on Sundays. So, Ben, let's talk for just a little bit here. Why does the community of people who are trying to follow Jesus, why do we gather?
Well, this is really important that you bring up. It wasn't just for Sundays. In the Roman world, and this is another moment where the hardest thing to understand is what it's like to live in the first century occupied Palestine. In the Roman world, you know, there's no civil services the way we like it. There's no fire department. There's no police force. There's no even the judicial process was very different. You know, there's a variety of differences. But one of the key differences is all of these things that we count on for our society to function and for our, in America, we like to say our individual rights to be maintained, was that there is a structure set up so that if there is an abuse, at least in theory, there is an appeals process so this can happen. Well, that doesn't exist for Rome. The Romans basically said, you're on your own. You figure that part out. We're going to worry about foreign policy, and we'll handle some civil cases here and there. But really, how do you protect yourself day to day?
Well, and this just goes back to occupied Palestine you mentioned. Yeah. And there you've got Roman soldiers who are not under the constraints they would be in Rome, is my understanding. Yeah, who really had the ability to conscript you to do whatever they wanted you to do.
Precisely, under the assumption that almost none of you are going to be Roman citizens because you're a province, you're not, you know, to be a citizen at that time, your father had to be a citizen.
Yeah, well, and
well, that makes it pretty tough, you know.
And Palestine, on top of that, is a hot spot. So they're seen as rebels.
Right.
So you treat them even different than you would another occupied area.
Right, and one of the major reasons it's a hot spot is, sort of because of the internal conflicts are always there and are still there, but also because it was a very, very recent province. You know, when Jesus is born, it's not officially a province. When Herod is in charge, they have a kind of weird status. It's only when they start bringing in regular prefects, you know, Pilate was one of those, that then it'd be, so it was a very, very recent and it was a province and it was very confusing and it was this whole challenge. But the challenge for, well, then how do we protect ourselves? How do we live? Well, you had networks. We like to think we're the networking generation, right? We have social media and all of this. They networked better than anybody else. If you can't protect yourself, you have friends who can help you. And that is, if you read any Roman literature and you see friendship in there, it's such an important point, because what a guest friend, what that meant was you could go to their house, they'd let you in and they'd protect you, and they wouldn't even ask what had happened. And that was the kind of friendships they'd established, because you had to have them. You had to have people who were more, who could help protect you. And we see this, like, for instance, in the book of Philemon in the New Testament, what you have is Onesimus has had some problem with his, is a slave, has had some problem with his master Philemon. We don't know exactly what that is. He could have run away. He could have had some kind of a theft. Something has happened. And what does Onesimus do? He has to go to Paul, someone he knows, to try to talk to Philemon on his behalf, because, of course, there's a power dynamic of a slave and master. And that was very, very common. You yourself don't have much clout, but if you're part of a larger community, now we, the whole community, will do this. And we
okay. And that, to me, is the whole point of why we're talking about this.
Precisely.
We are such an individualistic culture, and we feel powerless. Should we feel that? Should we kind of go, duh? You know, I mean, yeah, we network, but we don't network. We're not. It's not the same thing.
No, it's really not. And because it's hard for us to imagine a world where that's so necessary. And that's why when Paul is so frustrated with the people in Corinth, I don't think Paul has nearly as much problem with which side of the debate they take as much as that they're having this aggressive divisions among them, right? That depending how you read it, there might be 2 to 6 different divisions in this group. And what he's saying is, you're losing the whole point. This is how we live. I cannot even believe that you're thinking about living like this. For them, that was just such an obvious thing that our community isn't just about coming together and worship. Yes, you do that. But community was every day of your life. That's how you lived it out.
Okay, but I will bet that we have people listening to us right now that are longing for that kind of community. And we in the Christian community have forgotten what it means to be community. Or don't even, we haven't forgotten. Is that even the right word? Because we've never known it. How can you forget something you don't know?
And I think here's the example. You started out by saying the challenge of what's the lesson to learn from the persecuted church, right? If persecution, that was obvious. Because the persecution didn't just come from the state. It also came from just neighbors. Christianity wasn't popular yet. It became popular later, but not at this point. And the lesson to learn is, well, we don't have to do that anymore because, you know, we don't have that problem. Well, maybe there's something to be said for the time period where we had the most deliberate Christianity, the most deliberate Christians we have in this world at this time period did this. Just because we have the luxury of not having to do that maybe isn't something we should just say, well, we're done with that now. Instead, why don't we take the lesson and say, this was a really valuable community, not just for protecting your home, but for a variety of things, that the amount of support you can give to one another when you have that relationship already established is, to me, tremendously important and something that I think we can gain without saying, well, we have to wait for a persecution to gain that.
There's two things I'm pulling out of this that I think are critical. And I shouldn't say that. I've got to really think about the thoughts. Number one, we pastors have got to stop putting all of our eggs in the basket of worship attendance. So stop counting the butts in the seats, you know, as if that's our success. And the second part of that is then to ask ourselves as leaders, and not just pastors, but leaders within these communities that are trying to follow Jesus, how are we doing at being community outside of that context of worship? And I have to leave that open because I don't have an answer for that.
Yeah, and I think one, if we're talking about lessons, there's one lesson we can really learn from the early church, and we're talking about the marketplace, the way they evangelized, the way they were community. It was always in the public square. And it's the thing that in my opinion, that we really need to learn from the early church, a persecuted community of an illegal religion. They understood you change the world, you change culture by interacting with it in a very regular action. Paul takes jobs. People have, you know, Lutheran doctrine of vocation. They go and in your own field, you interact with these people in a very public way. And rather than ourselves thinking of ourselves as so very different, which is the Sunday morning thing, this is what we do that's different, instead, why don't we focus on the points of contact we really have? That's, you produce more culture, you interact more culture. That is always, for me, one very important lesson I feel that we can really learn from this early church.
You know, Ben, I appreciate your being on with me today. You know, I love you very much, and you're a very important part of my life, you and your whole family. And I'm just delighted that you took this time to be with us. And to all of our listeners, I'm so glad you tuned in today as well. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Praying with the Eyes podcast. I would ask that you please subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And with your subscription, I also would ask you to rate the podcast and write a review. Those reviews are going to be very helpful to me in improving where I need to improve, and and to be encouraged by that. And it helps. Here's the deal. This the iTunes is part of the community where the marketplace. And these podcasts can be listened to by people around the world and are listened to by people around the world. The broadcast was. I had people all over the world that had listened to those broadcasts when they were on the Ivy Network. Your help is really critical because iTunes pays attention to those podcasts that are rated and people leave comments. So please do that. I would really appreciate it. I will look at those when I figure out how. This is new to me, but I'm spending a lot of time. It's worth the time to do that here. I would also encourage you to post a link on any social media, if it's Facebook or Twitter or somewhere else, to this podcast. That would be much appreciated. As those of you know, I don't get paid anything for it. It's not about money for me. I am so grateful that Holy Cross sees this as part of their ministry, and my support comes from that community to do this. So it's about wanting to get the word out and people engaging in this conversation. I would invite you to join in daily following my my devotions at my website, prayingwiththeeyes.com. You'll find all of them there, plus, as I mentioned earlier, other blogs written by other people, friends of mine. I want Ben to write some here, too. After this conversation, I think it's going to be good for him to have that exposure there for you to follow up with sometime, too. Please do that. If you want to listen to those daily devotions instead of read them, you can go to SoundCloud and search for Praying with the Eyes, and you'll find them there. Again, email me at prayingwiththeeyes@gmail.com. You want to check out what's going on at Holy Cross, please do so by going to our website at holycrosscs.org. If you live in the Colorado Springs community and you do not have a church home, we would invite you to be a part of our community here. We worship on Sundays at 8, 9:30, and 11 with the Bible classes, Sunday school, 9:30 for adults and children, and for adults at 11 o'clock. We'd love to have you be a part of that and become a part of our community. We also have a ministry called Life Tree Cafe. And on Mondays and Tuesdays, we meet from 11:45 to 12:45. We discuss really important issues and topics around a video base. We get in small groups. Your thoughts are welcome. Your doubts are welcome as a part of Life Tree Cafe. If you want to follow me, you can do so on Twitter at Praying With Eyes or join my Facebook group at Praying With The Eyes. And again, you can go to our webpage at prayingwiththeeyes.com. I look forward to joining you in our next episode. Thanks for your download of this podcast.
Thank you for joining us on this edition of the Praying with the Eyes podcast. These podcasts are produced by Laird Production, which you may contact at lairdproduction.com. For thoughts and questions that you may have, please email Doug at prayingwiththeeyes@gmail.com. Be sure to subscribe to the Praying with the Eyes podcast on iTunes as well as post a review. We invite you to tell a friend about today's podcast by posting a link on your social media account. We look forward to being with you in our next episode.